letter away from IBM is just a coincidence. But I think we're a long way from artificial intelligence. But to have specific intelligence where you can program it to avoid all of the kinds of obstacles that you can anticipate, that, in my opinion, is very doable. But so we're going to be sending better and better machines to the moon, Mars, asteroids, and whatever. But to put man on the moon, I keep saying it, Paul, I'm convinced that your and my grandchildren, and maybe even our great-grandchildren, I say are not going to see a human being standing on Mars. The risk is much too high, the cost is much too high, the benefit is much too small. You're way ahead of the game to send a machine with what you think is AI. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, I would question this on this particular, on this general subject you're talking about.
Okay, Dick, by the way, you put in the SMAP spacecraft. NASA has a good video of what this thing is doing, you know, the way it's spinning and how it's sitting on an angle and spinning above the transmitter and how they're getting this 600-mile wide path as it goes overhead. So that's pretty good. Want to look at that. And as far as the vertical takeoff and landing, you know, I know we've been doing that for decades. You know, we landed on the moon like that with LEM. But I mean, as far as autonomous landing and hazard avoiding technology, you know, that's relatively new. But the NASA is already really ahead of the game with the with Morpheus in there. It's a liquid methane engine and liquid oxygen, and that's how they fly that thing, and they've done it dozens of times. They fly it into this homemade field with boulders and rocks, and it successfully lands. And, they've been doing quite a bit of that. So they're getting there. It's not AI. It's not HAL 9000, but it's pretty good. Back to you, Dick. I heard a couple of stations.
Yeah, I recognize Wes and Joe in that order. Wes has a comment. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, I've heard from you a few times that you don't believe that your grandchildren would be able to see the Mars, but how could you possibly be able to foresee iPhone becoming so powerful in 1952? Probably didn't even know that cell phones are going to be there. And you definitely didn't know about the iPhone. The reason I brought that to your attention is that the progress is amazing, and Murphy's Law is actually working. So I don't believe you're going to be waiting that long. Get to it, Jim.
I don't blame you for believing that, Wes. But the sheer logistics involved, I mean, you look at the number of tons of stuff every month brought up to the International Space Station in order to create life support for those 3 to 6 astronauts on board. The amount of water, food, and air that N2XJN consumes in 1 year has the volume of your house and it has the mass of your house. That's how much consumables you go through in 1 year. And a mission to Mars is 3 or 4 years round trip. Where the heck is all that stuff going to come from? On top of that, the cost of the mission in 2015 dollars is probably something like $3 trillion. Where's that money going to come from? You're going to have to get the cooperation of almost every advanced nation on this planet.
Yeah, but did you notice that after the Gagarin attempt to conquer the space, America didn't ask themselves what we're going to get the money from. They put all of the money. So in other words is, when we look at the prices of the oil right now and we see very low, and then when we were in Iraq we were seeing about $5, then the answer is very simple. Money is illusion. When there is a goal, there is a progress. And Chinese are going to be there pretty soon at 2XGN.
Jake, I agree with you. We may see a man land there, but to land there and come back, I don't think we'll see the return.
Now, let me try this one on you, though, Wes. The moon was a $32 billion project of Apollo in 1970 dollars. Mars is close to 1,000 times further away. Maybe it's 3,000 times further away. If it was linear in cost, we're into $100 trillion here. You know, huge numbers in dollars. And yes, some of it's going to get cheaper. Huge numbers of pounds of consumables are required to keep man alive. And in the case of going to the moon, yes, we spend a ridiculous amount of our expendable money because we were scared to death about Russia at that time, the so-called Cold War. We had to get there first. We thought it was life or death almost. In the case of Mars, you don't have that driving force. You have something that's 1,000 times or so more difficult, maybe 1,000 times more expensive, at least 10,000 times more dangerous. Yeah, you're going to get people that'll volunteer, even though it's a one-way mission. Let me drop it. And the technology of spacecraft propulsion systems and life support systems, they're all going to get better. Well, they're going to get 1,000 times better in a lifetime of your and my grandchildren. It's an interesting question. So maybe I shouldn't say it's impossible. I better say it's an extremely tall challenge, an extremely expensive challenge, and each of those nations that are going to have to contribute to it are going to say, what am I getting in return? What do I get for my money? And so, when it comes to cost effectiveness, it may be 10,000 or 100,000 times cheaper to send a unmanned spacecraft rather than send a man. To maintain life in space is a hell of a lot more difficult than first meets the eye. Joe, you had a question on all of the above. To me, to RYY, K2RIW.
Who's going to volunteer for a one-way mission?
Yeah, I did have a question. It had to do with you talking about the Voyager being way out there. My question very simply and very quickly is, how does this thing know navigational-wise how to precisely always steer its antenna back to Earth? By what means of it is it doing this to where it can always calculate, know exactly where it's going to put this pinpoint of a signal back to Earth all the time? Back to you.
Yeah, it's got specific stars it knows to look at, to point at. It's got a computer program to let it know what the Earth is doing in its orbit. And that 1 degree, or is it half a degree, beam width dish, I think it's an 8 foot diameter or 10 foot diameter dish running at 8.4 gigahertz. And I can do that calculation, but it's in that order. It's got to be very precisely aimed at Earth, otherwise it ain't going to hear us and we ain't going to hear it. So it can look at the sun, and it can look at Sirius, and it's got a number of stars that it uses for orientation.
I think it's 12 feet, Dick.
Say it again, 12 feet, okay. So that spacecraft we're now mentioning, Voyager, 12 foot diameter dish, 8.4 gigahertz, and let's see now, my 2 foot dish was 3 degrees, 2 foot to 12 foot, 6 to 1, 1/6 of 2 degrees, a third of a degree. It's got a roughly third of a degree beam width. It's got to be aimed precisely at Earth, and it does it by Das Stargazing Sternwerks. Over to you, Joe, to B2RYY, K2RIW. Oh, by the way, one other thing I was going to mention. When it comes to one-way volunteers to go to Mars, a number of people have already stepped forward saying, I will do that. That amazes me. Over to you, Joe, to B2RYY, K2RIW.
No, that was it. I was just kind of always amazed on how the navigational process works, how this thing can always know where the Earth is supposed to be. And I guess it's using some sort of, I guess, a camera system to be able to look at it to know what it can, I guess, for other words, better words, optically see out there, so it knows how to triangulate itself and aim itself accordingly.
You've got it, Joe. Every spacecraft that we launch has got the exact same problem. They almost all have a high-gain dish that has to be aimed at Earth in order to get the high data rate of transmission of data. And even though you've got a 12-foot dish, which is about the biggest thing they ever could have put on Voyager in 1977,
37 years ago, and to make a traveling wave tube operate essentially continuously for 37 years, that's a damn good trick. Boy, that's a high reliability traveling wave tube and power supply. 20 watts of output with a nuclear power supply that's still cranking. That's one hell of a success story. And yes, even though the dish is as high in gain as you can get, the frequency at the time is the highest you could have used, the traveling wave tube is the biggest tube you could use at the time that you can squeeze onto the spacecraft to run with that power supply. So everything was already flat out. And at that range, they're down to something like 50 bits per second is the maximum data rate. As your signal gets weaker and weaker and further away, the only way you can keep that signal above threshold is to make the receiver more and more narrow. It's a phase lock loop, very fancy receiver, the Deep Space Network transponder system. Let me join. So they're now down to something like 50 bits per second. You could say the receiver has 50 hertz of bandwidth at 8.4 gigahertz. And the only way you can do that, I mean, by ordinary circumstances, you never get enough frequency accuracy out of a crystal that's drifting and aging and temperature variations and whatever on the spacecraft. You could say that there is no crystal on that transmitter, on that spacecraft. It uses as the reference the uplink signal. It takes the uplink signal and divides it by the ratio, 220 over 241, I think it is. 220 over 241, it's a set of numbers like that. So the uplink frequency versus the downlink frequency are that exact ratio. Could say that every cycle that you send up has a corresponding cycle of 8.4 gigahertz coming back down. You count those cycles and you have a ridiculous amount of range accuracy. There's a pseudo-random code that gives you coarse ranging, and the fine ranging is literally counting the cycles that went up and counting the cycles that came back down. As such, very minor changes in the velocity of the spacecraft as it moves away from Earth. And you think it's in, you know, has left Earth and it's out there in the solar system going toward Pluto and beyond. And by the way, it is three times the distance beyond Pluto right now. Let me drop it. You think that spacecraft is, in orbit around the planets. In orbit around the sun, or it's leaving the sun. It has achieved the escape velocity of the sun. And as such, you know exactly how much mass the sun has, because you can figure that out by knowing how much mass the Earth has, know the gravitational constant, know much how attractive force there has to be between Earth and sun in order to put us in this exact orbit at roughly 93 million miles away. So you got a whole lot of checks and balances there. Therefore, you know exactly how fast Voyager should be slowing down because it's being pulled back by the sun. And whenever they do that calculation, they kept finding out for the whole 37 years, it is slowing down very, very slightly with error, but it's slowing down faster than it's supposed to. And they finally figured out what it was sometime in 2014. One very enthusiastic guy gathered all of the data that was in all the tapes that were stored under the staircases of NASA. He looked over all those tapes and finally figured out what's going on. And that is the thermal energy coming off the electronics of the spacecraft and the nuclear power supply. All of that is on the backside of the dish. The thermal energy is being emitted as in a far infrared signal bouncing off the back of the dish. And just like a ionic engine, it is giving an extremely small amount of thrust that is operating in the opposite direction of the direction of travel, if you know what I mean. So it's the thermal energy reflecting off of the back of the dish is creating the error that they have continuously been seeing and didn't know what the hell was causing it as to why the thing is slowing down a little bit faster than it's supposed to. We're talking about the fifth decimal place here. But that deep space network ranging system, transponder system, has that kind of range resolution that could detect that.
Repeater, timeout.
So, we're at the end of our time. This was TechNet number 1541. And be kind to each other. Hey, John. Hey, John, tie the ribbons on it. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Bye-bye, you all. We'll see you next week. And we're going to settle some of these issues, it says here. If you believe that, we'll tell you another. guaranteeing there's more questions than anybody's got answers. But that's what the technet's trying to do. We're looking for those answers. Major RIW clear.
Hey, Paul.
Good night, Dick. Great technet as usual.
That guy's got good taste.
Mr. Lynn, have a good week. We'll see you next week. WGBWS to Lynn.
You gotta think big, Paul. Just think big in space. KGRIW.
I concur. John, I wonder if you could hear me. KC2WGBWS to Lynn. I copy you. Yeah, I copy you. Can you copy me? You turn my antenna. Maybe I should turn my antenna. Oh, okay, very good. Okay, you're a little low. Are you coming in on the input out in Selden?
He's being repeated from 85 to Selden, and you're hearing him by way of Selden. Right now, John, you're not coming out of 85, but you're coming out of Selden.
Okay, very good. Yeah, John, I would just want to let you know that on the computer net, N2WIN, that was giving you the advice, Jen. Remember that on the computer net, John? Yeah, okay, yeah, that's my daughter. Okay, so that's why I was able to call her up and talk about the phone that she was also sending out. Somebody else told her how to shut it down. By the time I told her, she already shut it down. Back to you, John. I have an argument with my computer all the time, every time it breaks. And so, very good. They're over on the South Shore, it's closer to the, Great South Bay group. So, very good. Yeah, John, AI, it's around the block. You know, I can yell into my computer and it'll bring something up. If I say SpaceX, it'll work. I don't have to type it. Very good. Yeah, and anytime they break, I yell back at it. So we're getting close. Very good, John. I'm going to turn in. Have a good night, and we'll catch you next week. KC2WGBWS.
VA6 Lima Mike.
Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Time is 2:38 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 2:39 a.m.
Line report number 1950 with a release date of January 30th, 2015 to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Radio politics in Thailand has ham radio caught in the middle. Two more world-circling Pico balloons are launched from Australia. The ARRL announces some DXCC and VHF contest rules changes. South Africa Hamnet assist in mountain rescue. Ham radio featured on New York City's Save a Life television program. And amateur radio helps an old radio telescope see its first RF light. And scientists launch sounding rockets during surprise auroras over the Arctic. These stories and more as Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1950 comes your way right now.
I'm Peter Nash, N5ASH, in the newsroom with this breaking story. Starting February 17th, the FCC
no longer will routinely issue paper license documents to amateur radio applicants and licensees. The Commission has maintained for some time now that the official amateur radio license authorization is the electronic record that exists in its Universal Licensing System, or ULS, although the FCC has continued to print and mail hard copy licenses. In mid-December of 2014, the FCC adopted final procedures to provide access to official electronic authorizations, as it had proposed in WT Docket 14-161, as part of its process reform initiatives. Under the new procedures, licensees with an active status only will access their current official authorization via the ULS License Manager. The FCC will continue to provide paper license documents to all licensees who notify the Commission that they prefer to receive one. Licensees also will be able to print out an official authorization as well as an unofficial reference copy from the ULS License Manager. According to the Commission's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau, the new procedures will save some $300,000 a year, including the cost of staff resources. In addition, the WTB says...
Tonight at 8:30, this is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
N2ASS.
Net tonight at 8:30, WQVL Repeater System.
2KZ, November 2, Kilo Zulu. It is indeed N2KZ listening. We're over in Stratford, Connecticut. What fun. N2KZ.
Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater.
N2EB, N2EB, N2ZEB. Anybody out there, this is Kilowatt 6, Darling Purple Zombies, Mobile in Oceanside. Anybody around?
K6DPC N2ZEP Mobile.
For the beep, no beep. Good morning. Just on my way to Richmond Hill. It's not too bad out here in Oceanside. There's snow, but this little mini really goes over it beautifully.
Well, I'm on the Northern State at Glen Cove Road, and I see black pavement, which is nice to see.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, you gotta drive careful in this mess, that's for sure. I'll be going on Sunrise Highway not too long. And you really gotta watch it very closely.
Well, I'm not assuming that all that is black is wet. It could be ice also. So I'm keeping the speed down.
I'm doing the same thing. You know, when you can't see really too well what it looks like, you know, if it's block ice or what. I'm going a big, 19 miles an hour. I figure that's safe enough. If I have to slide on something, I'll be able to control it.
I'm going a little faster than that. I'm up to about 45. But I'm keeping a nice distance between me and any other car.
Yeah, that's really all secret. You don't climb on anybody's tail feathers in this. You know, I normally keep a good distance anyway when I'm on the highway and stuff like that. People don't realize you can't stop on a dime in good weather or bad weather when you have a lot of mass that's moving. It's not going to stop that rapidly. Just basic physics.
Now, I drive a crossover, and I take a look at the big SUV four-wheel drive drivers, and they think they can drive and stop on anything. Physics is against them. four-wheel drive, does nothing on ice.
Right. Well, you're talking about the soccer mom complex, right?
Not just the soccer moms. It's the macho men who think, oh, I got a big four-wheel drive truck, I can drive through anything. The best is when there's a big, heavy snowstorm and the guy isn't willing to sit in the traffic, so he decides to drive on the right shoulder, not realizing that the right shoulder is not level, it's pitched to the right, and he turns his vehicle on its right side.
Yeah, well, you know it is. They think they have a heavy vehicle and they can dominate. It doesn't work that way. It really doesn't. Yeah, you know, I'm very cautious because I drive a little car and I try to watch myself. Plus, I have a 500 watt PA in here, and if somebody gets out of hand, I give them a piece of my mind.
Be careful with that 500 watt PA. It could come back with someone with a tire iron.
You ever hear of a machete?
You know, you take it and you keep escalating it. It's best to avoid it if you can.
I agree with you. There's no question on that. You know, the first thing I'll do is hit the siren. And, you know, hope that they get the word. And if they still insist on, you know, cutting in front of me, then I'll use the PA. And if they insist on stopping, I'll see who gets out of the car. And if it looks like it may be a problem, I'll take off.
Well, if the guy wants to get in front of me, I let him. It's not worth having the altercation. What am I going to get there, an extra minute earlier?
Not this, you know, I'm not about somebody getting in front of me. That I don't care about. I care if somebody cuts me off to get in front of me. But it's common sense and judgment to know it's cutting me so tight that I'm going to get my front left side torn off.
That's when observation in the side and rear view mirrors is important. I've been able to predict these guys coming up along my side saying, that one's going to be in front of me in about a minute and a half. And my wife is amazed how I always know.
No, I agree with you. I've always kept the vigilance on my side mirrors, my back mirror and everything. And if something doesn't look kosher, I watch it. Same way coming to a stop line, if I see somebody barreling down on me, I immediately put it in the fifth to get ready to jump if I have to.
Well, if I see someone coming up and I don't like the way he looks, I just ease off the gas pedal.
Yeah, you gotta use judgment. I learned to drive when I was 15 and a half, 16. I'm 68. And, you know, over the years, I learned to be very cautious. And, you know, be respectful. But a lot of the drivers today, they have an arrogance, like a lot of the hams today that sell at flea markets.
I'm up to New Hyde Park, and I'm going a steady 45. And so far, everyone else on the road is being intelligent, and that's the important thing.
I'm going on Atlantic Avenue here, you know, Oceanside, and I'm going 21. And, you know, if they want to go around me, fine, but there's a speed limit here. This road has a very low speed limit, and it's near some schools. Village speed is 30. So, you know, I just doodle along. I don't have to make anything very fast. And when I get to my place, I'll get to my place. I'll stop for breakfast first, read the local rag, and then come in.
Well, that's what I'm doing. I'm leaving a little earlier than usual, so there's less traffic on the road, and I can give myself plenty of time. When I get into the city, I got a pair of shoes in my office, change into those, get out of the boots, have breakfast, do a little paperwork at my desk, ready to start the day.
I got up, and I got on the air 160 meters this morning, about 20 minutes, a half hour. Took Mendel out for a walk, and then decided, well, it looks like it's time I'll take a ride to Rich Man's Hill.
Well, for me, the only thing I did other than get up and get dressed was to clear the snow off my car so I had visibility. And legally, you have to take clear off the roof surface so that you don't spray back at the car behind you.
Well, I did. When I went out, I took the pooch out for a walk. That's when I started my car up. Left the heat on full bore. And by the time I got out to the car, the windows were already clean. A little bit of snow was in the front and on the top, and took care of that. And I'll tell you, this little stick shift car, I can't believe how well it goes over snow. It does a beautiful job. The whole trick is you go very slow until you get yourself going. And I had a little snow in my driveway. I got right out, and it did the deed. And you know what? The main thing I like about this car, the wheelbase in the back, is as big as a BMW's wheelbase in the back.
Well, I like the fact that I have remote start on my cars, and last night, after I filled both cars up with gas, I left them parked in the driveway. Windshield wipers off the glass so they don't freeze, and the ventilation system in high defrost so the remote start kicks in. Engine warms up, the car starts warming up, and the windows start defrosting.
I didn't bother putting a remote start in this thing. I may, if this type of weather continues, I will put remote start in. I just got in when I took the pooch out. I tied him to the back of the low band antenna for a minute, got in the car, kicked over the engine, and started very fast. You know, so it was good. And off I went, letting it run, and had the frosters on and the heat on. And then when I got into it, about 10, 15 minutes later, it was all nice and toasty. I'll tell you, I went out last week to the plane, and every week, because I haven't had a chance to flying lately, I'll run up the engine. And it's interesting because before you can even run the engine up on that ship, I got to prop it through about 5-6 times by hand to soften up the lubricant in the combustion chambers. But once I wind up the lubricant, I get in, prime it, that little puppy starts just like my car.
Well, you gotta know the vehicle. In that case, it's an aircraft. It's gotta be maintained properly.
The other thing is, it has a 24-volt battery, not 12-volt. The battery is about almost $500 to replace. And in the information it said, in wintertime, try to maintain a charge on the battery so it doesn't get a chance to really freeze and run down. So when I kick it over, I run up the engine for about 15 minutes. And I'm seeing, you know, that I have no problem. I put on the beacons, landing lights, and everything else. I'm not showing a discharge, so I know the battery is good and hot. And then I'll shut it down.
Well, the other possibility is depending on whether you've got the plane in a hangar or out on the tarmac and just with tie downs, is put a flow charge on the battery.
I'm parked outside on Echo Ramp. A hangar is like $350 to $400 a month at Republic. I'm dropping about $140. And basically, you know, Even to try to take the battery out, let's say, and be able to just charge it, it's set up under the cowling. You have to pull the cowling to pull the battery. So I figured best, you know, at least every 7 days I'm not here flying in some of this weather, just go out, run it up, and you'll get the charge into it. Because I don't want to replace the battery.
Well, here's the flip side to it. It may cost you $100 or so to replace the battery. How much is it costing you in aviation fuel to run that engine once a week for 15, 20 minutes?
Battery is over $500 to replace a 24-volt aviation battery for the Cessna.
Okay, I thought you said 100, not 500.
Oh no, it's an expensive battery. Anything the FAA, you know, that goes in an airplane, figure between 5 and 10 times more than what it should normally cost. No, and it's no problem, you know. And basically, I burn 5.5 gallons an hour. So let's say I'm up for 30, you know, running it for 30 minutes. So I burn, let's say, 2.5 gallons. It runs you about $12, about $6 a gallon. So, you know, for $12 to make sure everything else is in good shape, I'm not going to worry about it.
You just got to put two of them in series, two 12-volt batteries.
Work. Two 12-volt batteries would weigh too much. I've got a limit of weight situation in that plane.
Yeah, let's think of that.
So the FAA, you know, will not allow something to go in there that's makeshift. It calls for a certain battery, certain part number, and a Cessna, you know, puts it in the manual, and that's what you have to replace it with. So an aircraft is not like a car. A car, you get away using a lot of aftermarket parts and all this stuff. With a bird, you're limited. Steve?
You also have the situation that the battery case is configured for a specific battery. You're not going to get two 12s in that same physical space.
No, it's a specific battery, and the, you know, it's, you have no choice. You know, like every 2 years, you got to go through a whole static pedal test for checking the transponder and coding altimeter. Every year, it's an annual. You know, it's more than a boat, believe me. Well, look, when you're up there, you can't get out and, you know, have it towed in.
Now, I would keep that plane as close to specs as humanly possible.
Steve, I totally agree with you. I'm going to have my tail feathers in that puppy. I'm not going to let anything go to chance.
Well, I'm coming to an area that I'm going to start sounding a little bit noisy, Al. We commonly call it the trench in Queens on the Grand Central. So if I get noisy, that's why. Traffic has also picked up, and as a result, the speed has dropped. But I'm still going to get in very early today.
Don't blame you, Steve. Oh, wow. Wow, some car really splashed me. No, one other thing I did was, being where the plane is parked at Republic, on takeoff, you don't have too many options if, let's say, the engine decides to do a number. And at full RPM on takeoff, the most chance if an engine's going to fail, that's the time it's going to do it. What I did, I got myself a different type of propeller. There's two types of propellers you can be used on that airplane. Steve, did he sign out? This is NEP, K6DPZ, are you in there?
K6DPZ into ZEP. It sounded as if we had a third party in there and you were talking to him, so I backed off a little bit.
ZSE. You heard what I was mentioning, didn't you? ZEP, K6DPZ.
K6DPZ into ZEP. Do you copy me?
Copy it. Are you copying me?
I got you, but I thought there was a third party here.
ZSE came in. Steve.
Is he still here?
Came out. I think I had something to take care of. No, just me and you.
Okay, because I heard you commenting to him about engine failure on takeoff, and it sounded as if he and I had maybe doubled.
Oh, no. He left. Am I getting an okay right now?
Doing fine, but as I said, I just went through my noise zone, the trench, and there's another noise zone coming up a little bit.
Okay. No, what I mentioned was I changed the propeller because, you know, the biggest risk on takeoff is having an engine failure or throwing a rod or something like that, because basically you're full RPM. So I changed out the prop to be, instead of a cruise prop, a climb. reasoning for that is taking off. Hold on a minute. On the back, you got idiots here. Hold on. The climb prop will give me up a lot more altitude in a given time. Where if the engine does decide to take a dump, I got more options where I could possibly put it down because I have more altitude to work with.
Okay, it makes sense. So in other words, once your wheels up, wheels off the ground, you do a fairly high rate of climb at the beginning.
I climb out about the 450 to 500 feet per minute, depending on how much fuel's on board, so on and so forth. But at least I get up a lot faster, because when the engine dies, you can't make a 180 and go back. You got to figure what's in front of you, weigh your options, and then take it from there.
Yeah, I would assume so. The nice part about it being a Cessna, since it's small, there are multiple places you could set it down if you're a skilled enough pilot.
You know, it's not so much skill. It's also a lot of luck, too. Because you could be real skilled, but if the options are not with you, no matter how skilled you are, you still be in deep doo-doo.
That's where the old adage is, any landing you walk away from is a good landing.
Right. They're old, they're bold pilots. There are no old, bold pilots. But what you want to do, basically, is pick your spot, and once you pick it, don't change it. And pick a spot that, if you have to come down in an area where you have not too many options, try and figure you're expendable. You don't want to really try to hurt anybody on the ground.
Well, that's where a ball field, if it's big enough, is the best place to go if there's no game going on.
If you're close enough to a ball field or a golf course, and then always you have the highway, and your option on the highway, you got to make sure that there's no low bridges. It's a lot of things that enter in, but you always have to think about it. You can't be in la-la land when you're up there. Because you know when something can happen, and you have to just handle the problems. Luckily, I get in 600 feet. It has what is called stall wings. And I can drop it at 600 feet, and I can take off at 600 feet on a cool day.
Okay, I'm on the, going on to the LIE crossover, and there's a lot of flooding over here. I gotta pay attention to what I'm doing. I'll be back in a couple of minutes now, 10-2 Zeddy Pig.
On the bell action here, too. Go ahead, do your thing. I'm gonna keep my mind on what I'm doing, too. I do multitasking, but primarily it's driving in front of me.
6 DPZ and 2 Zeddy Pig, I'm back.
This is K6 DPZ, just on the transverse from the Belt Parkway into the Van Wyck Expressway. Ooh, we got some water. Good. No, I'll tell you, being has stall wings and a climb prop. Luckily, I'll be able to get in out of something pretty tight. But the only thing on the climb prop, it's not as efficient as cruise prop. So I'm burning a little more fuel, but I figure for the safety margin, it's worth it.
Safety over money, I'll take safety any day. I'm taking a look at the rain and the way the water's starting to pool because the storm drains are covered from the snow. It's going to be fun late this afternoon. I'm glad I will be home by then because these roads are going to ice. And hopefully things will clear up before I have to drive the next time, which is tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, I may leave at noon myself. I got projects in Oceanside to do. And I got projects in Richmond Hill to do. So it's a toss-up, which ones are going to get done? Well, Richmond Hill's first. But now I've got Oceanside. See, I have a complete lab in Oceanside also set up.
Well, what I would do if I were in your case, you're on the way to Richmond Hill now. Take care of those. As many as you can this morning. Get out before before the temperature starts plummeting, and then tomorrow morning do some Oceanside, and if the weather clears up, go back to Richmond Hill in the afternoon.
That was my thinking. Yeah, I've got a few projects over there sitting in Oceanside. Richmond Hill, I got quite a few projects I'd rather catch up on. If I don't keep stuff long, you know, we turn this stuff around less than a week on the stuff that comes in. As long as I have parts availability, there's no problem. And I got some stuff right from, let's see, what we have in there sitting immediately. Swan 270, Collins Bus Line. I'm just trying to think. Have to finish up the Central Electronics 100Z. So I got a pile of stuff, and I just triage it and see whatever comes first.
Well, if there's some equipment that you want to, that's not too heavy to move, you might want to throw one or two smaller pieces in the back of the car, bring it back with you tonight, so if the weather's really bad, you've got more work to do with Oceanside tomorrow morning.
I have six pieces in Oceanside sitting, and that will keep me busy enough up there. And on some of the pieces in Richmond Hill, the problem is if I take certain pieces back, I have to pull the manuals from Plyberry, set cables from, Richmond Hill, and all these things. Where I have a certain amount of test equipment, test cables and manuals on some of the pieces I work on sitting over in the Oceanside. But I'll see what happens. I get the stuff out pretty fast. I don't fool around.
Okay. If you got enough to keep you busy for one day, then you shouldn't have to transport anything.
I've got enough, and I've got to take time off. I got to write a shop manual. FAA requires for repair station. They came down already. I was interviewed. My facility was interviewed. But now I got to present the shop manual by March 1st. And that is a project. It's a procedural manual on how things are done in a FAA repair station. Procedures used.
Okay. Which means not only are they being restored to manufacturer's specs, but they're being tested in a certain manner.
Yeah, all it has to do with the testing, restoring, keeping. It's a whole thing. You have to present it for your operation. And applying for an FAA repair station off the field is no problem, as long as the FAA feels that you have the ability to handle the work, the equipment to handle the work, and so on and so forth. So they were out. I passed in those respects. Now it's just the repair station manual. And with all the stuff at this time going on in my life, I have a lot of different pressures.
Well, have fun writing the manual. I'm sure there are some manuals out there that you can pattern yours after and just customize it to make life easier.
That's it. Also, I know other people who have FAA repair stations. And, I'm a good basis with them, but when you say, I'd like to just browse through your shop manual, procedural manual, a little hesitant. They figure, once you get to the FAA repair station number, go after some of the prime works.
Al, I'm going into my second noisy zone. So when I come out of that, I'll be right at the tunnel. So this is the best time for me to say 7-3, drive safe, and stay warm. And 2ZEP clear.
And 2ZEP, K6DPC. Have a good day. You also drive safe. We'll catch you later in 2ZEP. Keep 6 Dalek Purple Zombies. It's QRZ.
WB2CMF.
WB2CMF.
KD2CWZ.
Kilowatt 6, David Peter Zebra Mobile, Richmond Hill listening. Anybody out there?
K6DBZ, K6KPJ, good morning.
K6KPJ, K6DBZ, good morning, Ernie. On my way to Richmond Hill.
I ought to move down there then. I'm not rich here, but maybe that'll happen. How did the tower and the beam go?
Well, they took down the beam from the tower, you know, in Richmond Hill. They were going to put it up today, and then the weather changed, so they got to wait till you get some good weather, then they'll throw the beam on the new tripod over in the Oceanside. Now, the weather, turned into a problem. They got everything down. They redid the antennas for the dinosaur, so chances are I can get the dinosaur up and running. I have to set up, though, Richmond Hill, then I got to go out to Long Island City and punch back the microwave and bring it on and everything. I don't know if I have enough time to do it today. I've got so many things I'm trying to do. But the antenna's up, at least at Richmond Hill. So we have the receiving antenna in Richmond Hill for the dinosaur. So, you know, we're in isolation. I just got to make sure everything is working. They turned the microwave antenna the right direction, so hopefully everything will fly.
That sounds great, Al. Yeah, the weather, I know it took a turn on us here with this rain. It's raining pretty good here. It's not heavy rain, but it's steady. And it's made a mess, because you can tell it in the street. I mean, everything, we have half frozen and half melted, but that's okay. As long as everything goes, even if you don't get everything done today, just be safe and get to where you're going. That's the main thing, because all the cars that are coming up our street here, I mean, they're not going, they're lickety-split. They're taking it easy.
I take it easy in this journey, I'll tell you. I got up about 4 o'clock. I decided to go on the air. I was on 160, and I talked to one of the stations, and then I took the poops out. And I said, well, it's about 5:30 or so. I'm going to go towards Richmond Hill, get here a little earlier, and take care of some stuff, so I'll make it back to Oceanside a little earlier to do a few projects we have there to do.
That sounds good. Got the day planned anyway. I just wish that it wasn't raining and it was just that powdery stuff down there, I'd be fine, but it makes her a slick drive. And that little car of yours, though, what the heck they call it? Anyway, you know what you're driving. But that little car, from what I understand, really hugs the road in the snow.
It does a very good job, Ernie. I can't complain. It's very stable, and with a wide wheelbase and everything, it's like driving a big car. A kick out of it. And, you know, having a stick, you have very good control of it also. So I hope, you know, if it starts clearing up later in the week, they'll put the tri-bander back on the Richmond Oceanside, and we'll have 10, 15, and 20 horizontal. 160 through 10 vertical, and we have the the 2 meter beam, the 440 beam, and the omnidirectional antenna.
Boy, that's going to be great. Especially, I'm sure you don't have to do too much to them. All you got to do is mount them and get them mounted, do a SWR check on them, that sort of stuff, and then I think you're good to go. And being on 160 through 10 or 80, I think you said 10, but anyway, that is really a good one there. Maybe I can, when I can be real slick, I can put one down there behind the house and hide it like I did my off-center pad. If I can get that 160 up there, I could take ground me off center fed and use that all the way. I have the room. I just have to get it hidden well. But, you know, we'll come up with an idea, and it usually works. Because I have my my 2-meter 440 and 220 beam up in the attic, and it works out quite well for me. K6 KPJ.
K6 KPJ, K6 DPZ. Yeah, well, it sounds like you got a good setup there. And yeah, everything is ready to go. You know, I got all my other antennas working. We're just, the tri-bander is really the top of the cake. And once we have that, you know, the tri-bander is going to be mounted below the 2-meter beam, the 440 beam, and then on top of all that is an omnidirectional VHF, UHF base station antenna. So I got it covered. I wanted some beams vertically polarized on the 2 meters, but I can't put any more on, you know, as far as that goes over at Oceanside. But I have some other direction finding equipment we're going to set up. I got some stuff that's Watkins Johnson, and this stuff is very interesting. The position of the station appears on the CRT in the magnetic heading.
That sounds really interesting, and I'm sure you're going to come up with something on that. But yeah, I can see where you can't put any more on that tower. But if you get an arm or two out there, you know, one way or the other, you might be able to do it that way. It probably looks like a tower for some cell phones about now.
K6 KPJ, K6 DPZ. Well, see, I put these antennas up in a progressive way. First thing I did was put up the high tower. Then we put the tripod on top of the roof of the house and put up the 2-meter beam and 440 and the omnidirectional. Now, step three is putting the tri-bander on top of the house on the tripod. And the tripod above the house is about 40 feet from the ground. So that's what they call the sweet height, where the takeoff angle is very good. Being right on the water, I have a feeling I'll be able to work across the pond very easily at 20 meters.
Oh yeah, yeah, as close as you are, you should be able to get on 17 and just just tell Europe good morning. I think that's about how it works. I get some good contacts from my 80 meter off center fed there in New Jersey, and it's the same way. I can hear somebody out there and wish them good morning, and I'm right into their shack. And that's worked out real well for me, because it's going north and south, and the other one I have is going to go east and west. I want to get that up sometime next week if the weather permits. If it doesn't, then I put it up a little bit later.
No, I can understand. Well, I'll tell you, this high tower is interesting because it's omnidirectional. I was on this morning about 4:30 in the morning talking to a couple of fellows on 75 meters in Texas. And then another fellow broke it in Canada, near Vancouver. So the antenna's working. And the thing is, I'm only running about 100 watts. I don't have a high power plugged up yet. I got it all up there. I just have to interconnect the cables. So with 100 watts, I see it's working. With a legal limit, I think I'm going to do some atom smashing.
Oh, I like to hear that. Because that's like when I put that TL-922 in line, and that's all going down to New Jersey. When I put that in line, it can really walk the dog out there, I'll tell you how. Just like yours. And I don't know what amplifier you're using there, but I have the 572 by Ameritron and the 811H along with the TL-922.
When I get everything set up, I have a KWS-1 working 80 through 10. That's 2KWPEP transmitter 7584. Then I have an S-line station with a 30S1. Then I have the ICOM station with a PW1. And then I have the Kenwood Yasin station with the Quadra. Did I miss any amplifiers? Well, then I have the VHF-UHF station with the Johnson 62 Thunderbolt. So I got a few pieces of hardware.
Boy, I think so. Like they say, do you think he gets out? And that's when you just say, you think? Oh, yeah. And there's some good skip out there, too. I would get on in the evening, say 11 o'clock at night, and I was working across the pond to those guys in Iraq. And there's a few of them that are out there all night long, but great signals on 17, 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm sure you worked some of them.
A few of them, but I don't work, I don't really bother with 17 meters or the bands are not harmonically related. I never got excited with 30 meters, 17 meters. For some reason, I'm so used to the harmonically related bands, 160, 80, 40, 20, 15, 10, and so on. But I'm going to do a little more listening. I got all the equipment that has capabilities going there. Let's see. Got the FT-1000 Delta, 756 Pro 2, 2KWM-380s, 746. Yeah, I get on those frequencies. And would you believe a couple rigs decided not to work when I started setting everything up? The 756 Pro 2 lost its receiver audio. The 746 transmitter died on me. I don't know, unless I'm just not used to the new location, I got to put them on the bench. But you know what they say, the barber has the longest hair. Listen, Ernie, I'm going to let you leave. I'm just pulling into my spot here in Richmond Hill. And I'll catch you later. And thanks for riding along with me. This is K6 Darling Purple Zombies, Mobile.
Okay, Hal. Have a good day. Be safe. Get from where you're going to wherever. Always be safe, especially in this weather. And we'll be talking to you. And we'll contact each other before we go back down to New Jersey so I can get a couple of frequencies that we can both hook up on, say on 40, 20, doesn't matter. I can go into all of them by 160, and we'll do that. K6 DPZ, K6 KPJ, 73s.
K6 KPJ, K6 DPZ. And Ernie, the offer still stands. Give me a call anytime.
I was just waiting until you get a few things done there, Hal, because you're busy, I know you are, but you need to take a break, and that's when we'll get together. But right now, I mean, we're still moving on this end, and you're moving on your end, but just not as far. But we're going to still get together. I'd like to have a nice lunch. That'd be great.
Take it easy. Don't work too hard. K6DP is at Georgie.
K6KPJ, we'll be listening.
KD2C, WB2C, MF Mobile, are you in Mountville?
Good morning, Pat.
Well, good morning. Not such a great morning, but it's a morning. More flooding here than anything else. That's what I'm battling right now. Just every corner is flooded, fortunately, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same thing over here. Slushy mess. This is heart attack snow. In fact, I'm walk into a mailbox, so I may be fading in and out a little bit.
This is not the type of snow that you shovel, you just leave it, I know in my driveway, It was already down to, the rain really knocked it down. It turned to rain real early. So there's maybe, I'd say maybe an inch and a half or so of just slush. I would anticipate that it's raining pretty good too right now. And that's just gonna wash it away. The plows came through about 5 o'clock. There was just, you know, once I got out of the driveway, there's just nothing. KD2CWZ, WB2CMF.
Yeah, WB2CMF, KD2CWZ. Yeah, plows came all around about 6 over here. So, yeah, at least we got newly plowed streets. In fact, it came down twice. Looks like we got about 2.5 inches. But it's a heavy, wet, slushy mess. You know, I had to get out there and engage the auto start and brush off the escape. That is it, Justin's car. But I don't know if he's going to work. He hasn't come out yet. Usually he leaves by 7:30.
Yeah, a lot of the school districts here out on the island have a 2-hour delay. In fact, we have a 2-hour delay. Like I told Chris, you know, the car was cleaned off, the streets were plowed. I don't want to be in that rush. You know, right now things are fairly quiet. You know, you still have to be careful. I mean, it's still slippery, you know. But for the most part, like Portion Road, it's pavement. It's more flooding right now than ice.
Yeah, same here. I was going to throw some salt down on the sidewalk, but I'm not going to bother. It's raining pretty good, and it's a straight rain now, so I'll just let the rain wash everything else off. Yeah, the tough thing is I gotta do my neighbors, too. Yeah, I feel like I'm committed to doing that, you know, for what she gave me to watch the house. So anyway, I'm done. I'm going in for a cup of coffee. I'm on my way back to the house. It's gonna be a do-nothing day, I guess. Gonna be stuck inside. At least I don't have to babysit. But I think Fall Park, Delville School District is closed.
Okay,
so I lose you, Pat.
But I guess the city schools did not have any delay. Janie went in normal time.
Oh, yeah, city schools, they don't close. You know, it's got to be like last week's storm. They're really scared that it's going to be a blizzard, then they close. And she said, you know, today is an easy day for her. A professional day or something. So one of the easiest days of the year for her. So she'd rather try to get in. I said if it's bad, she'll turn around. But you know, she's getting cocky with that all-wheel drive.
And you know, it gives you a false sense of security. Yeah, we got a call from the school. It must have been about 20 after 5. You know, I heard the phone ring, you know, the extra, you know, it was the high school. You know, with the 2-hour delay. So a lot of the schools were waiting till the last minute. And it's a shame, you know, Kristen's school had another bomb scare on Friday. Now, the regents were still going on. So I don't know what happens to those poor kids who were taking the regents. You know, that's going to be a sticky one. Fortunately, Kristen's still off today and tomorrow because she doesn't have any midterms. She's done with her midterms. So she's off.
But, yeah, because it's lousy out there. I just got in trying to take off this coat. The coat is soaked, so you know, because it's raining, it's straight rain. I think that's going to be it for me.
Hey, I didn't hear from you yesterday. Did you fall asleep or were you just all tied up?
I got involved. I finally got those files off of my Linux partition. You know, I found a nice program for Windows so that Windows will see. And I managed all my Linux partitions. I can't write to the drive, but I was able to save it onto the Windows partition. And then boot up in Linux and grab the files off of it.
Okay, so at this point you're all restored then?
Yeah, I'm read every file that I needed.
Yeah, it really worked good. I
like that program. It didn't even dawn on me that they would have some Windows programs that would do that. But yeah, with this program, it shows the Linux partitions. It was great.
Oh, so in other words, instead of mounting it on the Linux, you booted up Windows and mounted it on the Windows as read-only.
Yeah. I just wanted up the link out.
I just wanted you to see if there's a hum on this or not. But yeah, that's what I did. And they have a couple of things. They have another program where you could read and write to the Linux partition, but it's a little iffy. They say do it at your own risk. I found this other one, you know, read-only, and I was happy with it. It worked great.
Okay, yeah, I think I still hear a little hum, but not this way. You know, the audio on this link is hard to tell, you know, because between the popping and the buffleness. But yeah, I think I still hear.
It's in the connector. You're going to have to, you know, I'll bring it in the next time you're in, and we'll have to do something with it. But at least it's not a bad, bad hum anymore.
You know, the audio's louder, and the link buffles when it's really loud, so.